Dwight Falk with you here today, and Grant Turgeon as well. Thanks for being here, Grant.
Thank you.
You left your key card today.
I had to knock to get in here.
Yep. I did the same thing today too. Our minds are thinking alike. We have to have our little key cards to get into certain things, and I forgot mine too. It's crazy. You know why I did? It's because I change wallets. And every time I change wallets, then I always have
That's
a problem.
Tough. So I locked mine in my office as I was coming over here, so that didn't help me very much.
That's a rough day, but thankfully there's kind people that if you knock on the door, they'll let you in. So that's good. One of the headlines to take a look at today is an update here about Hurricane Irma. This headline says Hurricane Irma death toll rises, 90% of homes damaged in Florida Keys, and so. One of the things with these hurricanes is you don't really know the damage until you can get back in there and take a look at everything. And this says, as the death toll from the Hurricane Irma climbs to 23, and I think it's actually higher than that now, in the United States, residents of the Florida Keys are returning to a much different landscape than the one they left last week. As many as 25% of all homes in the Florida Keys were destroyed, FEMA Administrator Brock Long said Tuesday evening. And as many as 65% of homes suffered major damage. So people are coming home to find a disaster area. According to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, 90% of homes in the Florida Keys suffered some damage. So major, major impact there. And a lot of areas around Florida, but particularly in the Florida Keys.
It does seem like it's a pretty perilous place to live because aren't those the islands that have that one bridge from the mainland of Florida connecting them to all the islands? Mm. Like, if they're trying to get out, they have that one way to go. Otherwise, they get on a boat, but you don't want to be on a boat in the water when there's a hurricane either. So I guess it's a nice place to live, but at the same time, it's probably pretty dangerous too.
When the storms come in, for sure. Yeah, and now the problem is that the mass exodus is the reverse. Now people are trying to come home. Roads are jammed. It's hard to get through. And they're coming home to really bad situations like this. And so they said at least 23 people dead, though that number is climbing, I believe. 16 in Florida, 4 in South Carolina, 3 in Georgia died as a result of Irma, according to officials. Various causes, including car crashes, as well as carbon monoxide poisoning from improper use of a generator. So lots of ways to die in those events. It reminds me of years ago, I was living in an apartment in Edmond, here locally, and a tornado was coming through, and it was coming through Edmond, and the sirens were going off, and it was raining really hard, and everyone's nervous, so people got out of the apartments and were going to different places, and I got out too, but what I realized was the most dangerous thing was the car accidents, because on the way back after everything had passed over, you saw car accidents all over, because people were panicking. And, you know, they wouldn't wait for the red lights, and it was raining hard. Everyone was scared. So even though the tornado missed us, it went a different direction, there were a lot of car accidents. And I think in this case, some of these auto accidents, it could be something similar.
And that's what happens. It's a way of dying that people don't even think of. They're worried about getting swept up in the tornado, so they drive recklessly and think that the only way to die is in the tornado. Well, actually, you could die in the escape. You could die from, like you mentioned, the carbon monoxide poisoning in those generators. I heard one of those, I think it was a mayor from Florida, warning very strongly about that. If you have to use a backup generator, make sure that it is properly filtered or else you're going to get poisoning in your house.
Yeah. I'm always nervous about those things because you see things like that happen. So anyway, that death toll, I think, is rising. There's a new headline came out just real recently here. 5 dead and 120 evacuated from Florida nursing home due to intense heat and loss of power. So one of the problems that they're having now is, of course, wide areas in Florida don't have power yet, and it's warm, obviously. And so certain people, particularly if they're older or in a situation like that, now they're at risk. And so this it's not over yet in terms of the problems. Some other headlines, too, from it. Florida swelters, race for power, 5 dead at nursing home, which we just read, and then looters armed with sledgehammers. So there's some people going around trying to pillage still. So even though the storm has passed, now you deal with the effects of the storm and then just the evil of man that comes out sometimes.
Or you could think of it as some brave people rescuing shoes from the stores before they get flooded out.
That I've never thought of it in that way before, but it's crazy the things people do when severe weather hits. So anyway, this interesting story there. We'll, of course, keep looking at it. I haven't seen the official toll yet in terms of expense. I think they're still trying to figure that out. How much is it going to cost? It is interesting, too, even in talking about some of the different areas that were hit down there. There was, I believe, a local official that came out and tried to downplay it and said, well, it's not quite as bad as maybe some people think. And I thought, well, you know, you say that, but then if you're one of those people whose home's destroyed, you're like, yeah, no, it's pretty bad. So we look at it and sort of this like, well, okay, how many people were affected? But quite a few really were. And then, you know, if you've got your home destroyed, hopefully you have insurance. But even if you do, it's going to be a long road to recovery.
And I did talk to someone yesterday whose family is up there, living up there around Tampa Bay, and that's pretty far north in Florida, and they even have had their power out, and it's still out now. So everyone really is being affected across the state and even across the southeast region by that hurricane in some way.
Yeah, and then I saw last night in the weather, there's another tropical storm brewing somewhere down off of Mexico area. And I don't think it's going to become severe, but it is supposed to send rain up our area. So we might even get some of that.
Wow.
Which is good if you don't get tons and tons of it. So anyway, we're not out of the hurricane season yet, so we'll see what remains. And I'm interested to see what kind of a winter we're going to have here in Oklahoma. We've had such a nice summer that I feel like we're due. Like, you know, we've gotten a nice roll of weather, and now we've got to pay the price or something. I'm not sure, but we'll see.
It's like the summer has been too cool, and so we're leading into a freezing cold winter almost.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see what happens. Although we are getting back up into the mid-90s today, so... Or not today, but I think tomorrow.
Hmm.
But you love that. That's your weather
right
there.
It's like wearing a blanket outside. It's nice.
You only have to wear one jacket instead of two now. Yeah. The top story at thetrumpet.com today. Make sure you check this out. This is quite the write-up. Encouraging gender fluidity is child abuse. That wouldn't be a popular thing to say in some places. Now psychologists say two-year-olds know they are transgender. I had a two-year-old one time, twice actually, and I don't think they knew much of anything, quite honestly.
Not at all. They can't hardly tell you anything if you ask them, because they're just now learning how to talk at that age. They don't know how to make decisions on their own. They don't know right from wrong unless they're constantly being told. So how can they possibly decide something as life-changing as that?
Yeah, I wonder if they pick that age because it's an age where you couldn't ask them.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no way to, in their minds, maybe there's no way to disprove it, because you can't say, hey, well, what gender do you think you are? And it just look at you and then put something in its mouth. I mean, that's what babies
and
do.
And somehow that's a tell of what they think they are. That's really a diabolical plan. I would think that's probably why they chose that age.
It's a really interesting write-up. It's by Dennis Leap. He talks about the story on the Trumpet Hour program, which airs today, too, on KPCG. Make sure you listen for that. A really interesting interview talking about this story. And some of the things he brings up are really shocking, just in the way that really adults are influencing the children to go one direction or the other. They're trying to make it out like, well, we're just having an open environment. We'll just see what happens here. But they're very clearly pushing an agenda on the children. And as he brings out, and he's quoting some experts in the field that are coming out and saying, hey, listen, this gender fluidity that you're pushing on kids is child abuse. So he's not just, you know, coming up with his own thought on it. Obviously, we look to the Bible for the basic instruction there, but he's also looking at some experts in the world that are brave enough, and it takes bravery right now to say this is wrong and it's abuse.
It is, and there are people who are actually making money writing columns like that who are just espousing common sense, and really everyone should know it without it being written, and yet people still have to say it. They have to speak out now because common sense is just totally gone. You mentioned psychologists deciding that children at age two can choose what gender they are, or if they want to go back and forth at different times. that whole field is really, it can really lead to some extreme evils, because Sigmund Freud, who basically founded psychology, died of insanity in his 40s. He had all kinds of perverted ideas, and that's sort of what it's all about. It's just, it's about rebellion. It's about rebelling against God's authority, and that's what you see now, where these people think they're so smart that they can decide for two-year-olds what gender they should be.
Yeah, and I think we've mentioned it before, but if you just think about it in terms of things that other things we do in life, like driving cars, buying a home, things like that, you don't let two-year-olds do that.
No.
You don't even let two-year-olds cook dinner or really put on their own clothes. They can't do anything. I mean, there's so many things that if you allowed a child to do it, or you said, well, I think they're capable of making that decision, you'd be put in jail, I suppose. You know, if you just gave the keys to your two-year-old, turned the car on, said, have at it, you'd be on the nightly news, I'm sure. And people would look at that and say, well, that's crazy. Your kid's not ready to drive a car. You mean to tell me they're ready to know this type of thing? Which, again, there's nothing to know. It's pretty straightforward. There's some pretty good indicators as to which gender you are, from what I remember. And the whole thing is just so backwards. It's unbelievable we're even talking about it. But I mean, this is what's happening out there.
The choice of your gender, I don't think you should even call it a choice, but thinking that you can choose your gender is actually a more important issue than driving a car or cooking a meal, and yet that is the one thing that they think the children have the authority to decide for themselves now.
Yeah. Well, Dennis Lee brings up in his Trumpet Hour interview just some of the things that they're really putting this transgenderism, I guess, whatever you call it, they're really putting it there in the children's environment, exposing them to it, and then saying, hey, what do you think? Well, would you do the same thing with heroin? Here, try this. What do you think? Well, what are you going to have, a heroin addict? There's things you keep away from your kids, right? It's just common sense. Here, take this sharp knife. See what happens. Mm. You know, on those levels, I think most people have common sense. But then you start getting into this, and it's just everything goes crazy.
I think we've seen those videos where someone will show young children a video of maybe a song that depicts a lot of homosexual couples getting married, and the kids at first say, "Ew, that's gross, you know, I wouldn't want to have two daddies or two mommies." And then they keep showing the video to the kids, and then the kids and the person showing the video says, "Well, look how happy everyone is, and isn't this a really catchy song? And you know, wouldn't you want these people to be happy?" And the kids, eventually they're like, well, you know, I wouldn't want to make them unhappy. So maybe it is fine that they get married if they want to. And then all of a sudden, the kids have a totally different view 5 minutes later from what they had originally had at the start of the video. That's just how impressionable young children are. And it is just unbelievably perverted to try to influence them like that.
Yeah, it's a really, really staggering situation. You can read that at thetrumpet.com. Encouraging gender fluidity is child abuse. And also, it's talked about on the Trumpet Hour program today. So listen for that. Very interesting. Related to that, a booklet that you need to read if you haven't before, and even if you have, it's good to go back and look at it, Redefining Family by Joel Hilliker. Really a great expose on the changing social thinking of families. And you know, it's interesting, it was written a few years back, it was still extremely relevant, but it's also interesting to look at how much has changed even since that booklet was written. We've regressed quite a ways.
It's true, and yet that booklet remains as relevant as ever, because it does expose the strategy of just accepting these alternative family arrangements. It was plotted out and planned point by point how they're going to make this receive general acceptance from the entire country eventually. And you see that in every poll that says, well, you know, 60% or more now think homosexual marriage is fine. They think that having two parents of the same gender is just as beneficial to the child as having two parents of opposite genders. The beliefs in society in general are changing drastically because of a specific strategy to make that happen.
Yeah, it's not just random. It is a very much a plan, and it's working because they have control of the media. And if you have control of the loudest instruments of communication, then you get your message out there. And I mean, you see it. I don't watch much television outside of maybe the news here and there, and then maybe a sporting contest. But even there, it's getting weird because the commercials are so bizarre. Mm-hmm. But, you know, every once in a while, usually watching a game or something, they'll have a advertisement for a program coming up on whatever the network is. I'm not really familiar with them. I don't watch them. But you get the sense, even from the commercial, that it's a very odd construct living in whatever the house is that the show is about. It's hard to make heads or tails of exactly what's going on there. And you know, 20 years ago, well, it first became a big thing. There's a couple of sitcoms maybe years ago where they kind of maybe touch on those things very subtly. And now it's just, it's hard to find a program where there's not some sort of homosexual character or transgender or whatever's going on. They purposely build it into those shows. So if you're growing up watching that, well, I guess that's normal, right? That's what you've been taught.
The Redefining Family booklet does expose that as part of the strategy to try to put a homosexual in just about every show and to even overrepresent them, because in reality, those are not a huge percentage of the population. But in the TV shows, it's almost like they're nearly half of the characters, which is not a representation of the societal demographic at all. There's a lot of other strategies, like just avoid talking about what homosexuality actually is because it's a bit too gruesome for people to think about. You don't want to acknowledge the reality of it. Just make it seem pleasant and acceptable without getting into the details.
Yeah, they made their characters very specifically that way.
Yeah.
So anyway, really interesting. Check that out at thetrumpet.com today. Encouraging gender fluidity is child abuse. Also, listen for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. That's coming to you from Edstone, England. 7 a.m. and then, of course, replays at noon and throughout the day a few times. And the archives are at kpcg.fm and at thetrumpet.com. Talk today a little bit about Winston Churchill. And there's a couple of movies, I guess, about him, one that's come out recently and which was pretty revisionist from what I understood. And I think from what he said, there was another one coming out that may be a little more accurate. And the people reviewing it were really upset. They don't like the depiction of Winston Churchill as somebody who had, you know, because of his leadership, really saved the Western world from Nazi subjugation in World War II. They think they just want to revise that history, that he didn't have that big of a role, or, you know, it didn't quite go the way that that the actual history portrays it. So there's really an attack on history. We've been talking about that recently. And when you have a strong leader, particularly a white male, do I dare say, that really stood up and saved the West, they just can't have that. It just doesn't fit with the current narrative of down with white leadership, white male leadership.
We did start bracing ourselves for that movie to come out a couple months ago on this radio show, and it did sound like the movie was going to portray Churchill as not a visionary, but someone who was forced into action against his will every time. He didn't see the threats coming, but he was forced to act at the last second instead of preparing in advance for them. When in reality, he was the only one warning of what was coming, the Nazi scourge that was coming on Britain. And he saw it in advance. He prepared for it in advance. He wasn't forced into it.
Yeah, and if yeah, I think the revisionists are saying, well, you know, it was a coalition, and everyone worked together. And in the end, there was a coalition of nations, obviously. The United States came on board. Russia, they didn't really come on board with us, but the Germans attacked them, so they were fighting too. So, you know, if you look at, though, the way that it happened, you know, when the Nazis were just gobbling up territory, no one was taking a stand. And even people within Hitler's own administration said, if anybody had taken a stand early on, like when they went into the Rhineland, if France had taken a stand, or if the UK at the time had taken a stand, they would have stopped them in their tracks. But they gained courage and power and strength, and Hitler began to think he was a military genius because no one was getting in his way. But no one stood up to him until Winston Churchill did. And then, yes, later America gets bombed into it, Russia gets attacked, and they defend themselves. But early on, he was the only one that was standing up and rallying England to fight. And so it wasn't like some big coalition right off the top. Years later, it kind of happened that way, but he stood up when he was standing by himself.
This movie is just an example of putting ideology and an agenda ahead of even making a successful movie, because how much more inspiring would the movie have been if they went and they talked about how Churchill as a teenager saw that a grave threat was coming upon his nation, and that he knew that years into the future he would actually have a hand in saving his country. He saw that when he was, what, 16 years old? And then the fact that he was one man crying out while everyone else was virtually asleep, that's a way more inspiring story, a way better movie to make. And yet they put their own personal ideas ahead of a more successful movie, which it is their job. It is to make good movies. The truth would have helped them make a better movie.
I wonder, you know, I really wonder if I guess on some level they need to make money, but a lot of times it seems like they do want to make money, but at the same time they want to put out a propaganda piece mm-hmm. with a lot of things that come out of Hollywood, whether it be on television or whether it be on in the movie screens. And so it is interesting just the way they portray some of these events. But he did stand up and make a stand. And so that's talked about today on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Make sure you do watch that. there's that, what's that movie? It, Stephen King.
Oh, yeah.
I have not seen it, but I know that it's out there. There's been commercials. And I saw a headline the other day that it's made so much money that it's uniting America.
Really?
behind this demonic movie.
That's crazy. The scary clown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. It's too bad that that's the type of movie that would unite our country. It's a bad sign. If we had a good Churchill movie, an accurate Churchill movie, that would be something that would make Americans proud of our history. Even if we didn't have the leader, we didn't produce that leader. We did at least eventually go and back him up.
Yeah, so it's always interesting. And I think Hollywood's just struggling in general. People aren't watching the movies like they used to.
Well, how much money do you think they must be costing themselves by injecting propaganda into every single movie? I saw that new Spider-Man movie recently, and they were going on a class field trip to the Washington Monument, and one of the black girl characters said, I don't want to go see that because it was built on the backs of slaves. And so she was allowed to read a book off to the side instead of seeing the monument. And it's like, what does that have to do with Spider-Man? How does that have to be in the movie?
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, you do catch a lot of that propaganda in those movies that you wouldn't expect. You know, you wouldn't think it's about anything
totally
like
random.
That. And yeah, and then they throw that in there. So I always have to be careful when you go and watch a movie, particularly when you have kids too, because they're very impressionable and a lot of things can get slid in there kind of on the side. You can't ever trust the ratings either.
No.
You know, it could be any. I mean, there are movies out there which obviously are horrific. And then there are some that are a little more historical about war. Now they're gruesome, no mm-hmm. doubt, but it's a different type of thing. And then you have some that would be like PG or PG-13, and they're worse than the other ones, I think.
True.
Or yeah. even the general audience movies. Although there may be cartoons or whatever, they are sliding in some pretty dangerous ideology sometimes.
Yeah, the ratings are tough to deal with. It's almost like if you have children, you have to go screen the movie by yourself first and then watch it. No matter how innocuous the movie might seem, every single movie you have to watch ahead of time.
Yeah. Or just read a book. I don't know.
Yeah, read a book. It probably won't have as much of an agenda in it.
takes you longer to get through those. And, you can make your own movie in your head. That's what people used to do.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Actually, old-fashioned entertainment, and yeah. It probably had a lot better effects on our mind, too.
Well, that's why people are always so frustrated when they see a movie after reading a book, because mm-hmm. it doesn't look like you thought it looked in your head. You know, that I know of. Maybe there's been some good adaptations, but mm-hmm. most cases people are disappointed. I wanted to mention, too, putting a plug for the upcoming concert, the Oklahoma City Ballet, that's coming here to Armstrong Auditorium on Thursday, September the 14th at 7:30 p.m. You can go to armstrongauditorium.org to get your tickets. I think if there are a few left, there might be. And also they have all the upcoming concerts as well. So make sure you check that out. The Oklahoma City Ballet comes to Armstrong Auditorium this Thursday, and how about this, Grant? If it sells out, you'll buy cowboy boots and wear them.
I sure will. No doubt about it. I'll do that.
That's all the time. I don't care
okay,
what you're doing.
It's fine.
Playing basketball doesn't mean you could be wearing cowboy boots.
There are people who are like that, actually.
Probably so. Yeah, that would scuff up the gym floor, I think. Here's an interesting historical note for today. It just shows you where we've come in technology. 1956 on this day. IBM introduces the RAMAC, the RAMAC 305, the first commercial computer with a hard drive that uses magnetic disk storage. It weighed over a ton. Can you imagine having a computer in your office that weighs a ton?
What year is that, 78?
56.
56.
Yeah, it's way back there.
Wow. I didn't even know they were doing it back then.
You know, I don't know if this one was like this, but a lot of those computers back then, they had the tape, you know, like the reel-to-reel, and they're spinning all these things, and there's always, like, a bunch of technicians in white short-sleeve dress shirts and ties operating the machines. No, we don't know what they're doing. They're not going to Google.
No.
That's for sure. So that was back in 1956. It weighed over a ton.
Wow.
And now, today, just the other day here, Apple unveils its new iPhone 8 and iPhone X or 10. I'm not sure what they're calling that thing. And so that's coming out. And, of course, the iPhone 8 is, about $800. Or you can get one for $700. The Plus. The Plus means you pay an extra $100. And then the iPhone, the other one, the X or the 10. I'm showing my ignorance here about this. That's $1,000. So,
okay. Wow.
But they don't weigh a ton. You can carry them in your pocket. The here are the upgrades. If this means something to you, the smartphone is designed for augmented reality. I thought it always augmented our reality. it has a 12 megapixel camera, deeper pixels, new color filter, and the phone's also highlighted by new chips inside the phone. So they've upgraded their chips inside. It means nothing to me, but I know it would make it run faster, apparently. And then also the more expensive one, the $1,000 one, that is going to have a 5.8-inch Super Retina display and Face ID facial recognition technology, which can be used to unlock the phone for Apple Pay. So now you just put it in front of your face, and it recognizes you. And they say it'll even recognize, like, say, if you're a man, and you grow a beard and then you shave, like, you can build in, or you can, like, it can figure that out, apparently. So
wow. I actually did see some students yesterday rushing across the parking lot to try to get back to their dorm, and then they told me they were hurrying back so they could watch this launch of all these products. So it was a big deal. It seemed like a lot of people were interested in what was going to be said and what products were going to be unveiled.
And they also have some new watches, too. Mm-hmm. So if people want all that that gear, I don't know. It really is a big event for a lot of people, and I don't know. You know, the stuff that they're adding, I'm sure it's pretty neat or whatever. But unless you really have a need for it, I don't know. I think the thing that, like, when Steve Jobs was alive, I think the thing Apple did really well is they would show these new products in a commercial on TV, and they'd show you something that I'm like, oh yeah, I would do that. That's mm-hmm. neat. And then there's a lot of commercials where they'll show things happening, and I'm like, well, I wouldn't do that, or I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
Like, remember those Microsoft ones that would, like, turn into a laptop and uh-huh. And they just showed it, like, moving in different ways. And I was like, well, yeah, but I don't need to do that, so I don't care. So they need to break it down for a simpleton like me and show me what am I going to do with this? Why do I need this?
Yeah, there does have to be an element of even inspiration in some of those commercials. I think there was more of that when Steve Jobs was alive too. You could kind of see the real potential of those types of devices. Now I'm pretty much inspired to go to the Apple Store and flick around on it, but not really buy it.
Yeah, I sent you an email yesterday.
That was funny.
Did you get the joke?
Yes.
Okay. I sent this email to Grant because they had a picture from this unveiling of these new Apple products. And it's Tim Cook, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He's standing on the stage, and behind him is this huge picture of the iPhone. But it looks huge, and he looks really small. And so I sent it to Grant, and I said, no wonder it costs $1,000. Look at the size of that phone.
I said it was like a novelty item. It's pretty crazy how big that was. It better have said something like, "Not the item pictured is not to scale." Otherwise, right. That could be grounds for a lawsuit.
That's false advertising. I was expecting the really, really big phone. So I was hoping you got the joke, because I thought, well, either he's going to get the joke or he's going to be like, what is this guy talking about? But, you know, they set it up to where the background is sort of this neutral color. So, I mean, it almost looked like it was that big compared to him and the way he was standing there. So I don't envy him in his job, because Steve Jobs was the master at coming out and showing something that just blew the audience away. Mm. And so he has to come out and do the same thing.
Yeah, those are some gigantic shoes to fill for Tim Cook. And I don't know how he's doing. I haven't really paid attention to it in the last few years, but at least he has a really strong company to run. And so even if he's not as good as Steve Jobs at presenting those things, still those products are high quality and a lot of people want to buy them.
Yeah, I think they're living off of what they've done in the past. Yeah. And maybe they're still going that same direction. But a lot of places are catching up, a lot of different phones and things. Now I saw that they want to make I think it's Samsung, they want to be able to make a bendable or a foldable a smartphone. I'm not sure what the advantage is.
Back to the flip phone, it sounds
like. You know, if you wait, you have a flip phone. If you wait long enough, you'll be on the cutting edge of technology.
I'll be back in vogue, just like I planned all along.
Yeah. And the people that are a little older than you, they're still hanging under their boom boxes. They'll be coming back around too. Everything old is new again, right? They always come up with the new stuff. So anyway, kind of just interesting to look at where we've come in technology. Back on this day, 1956, IBM introduced a new computer that weighed over a ton. So
now we have supercomputers that fit in our pockets.
I know.
Just astounding.
Well, that's what's so amazing about it. Those huge computers from back in the day, the things that they were trying to do, now we do far more than that, I assume, just in our little handheld device. You know, I mean, if you stop and think about the internet, the fact that you can sit down and, you know, search for something and it instantaneously will pull up everything that has some sort of a reference to it. I'm always amazed because sometimes I'll be looking for a particular graphic or photo or something and the things that they pull in that are sort of related. And I'm like, well, how did they know like that this would be related to that? And then also, it's not like I'm doing it by myself, right? There's billions, I'm assuming, of people, millions at least, doing it at the same time, and yet it's working. I mean, it does boggle the mind.
It really does, because each search result that you pull up, at the bottom of the page, it says, like, this is just one of 200,000 or 4.2 million different possibilities, like different links that we could let you click on here. And really, like you said, it comes up in a split second, depending on your internet speed, I guess. It comes up really fast, and all those people are doing it at the same time. And it's like it has a connected web of all these different subjects that are somewhat loosely related, and it's basically like human intelligence almost.
The trick is, though, is to find the value in the haystack of information. Find the needle. So
because there's not much compared to how much there is on the internet.
No, there's so much out there, and so make sure you do bookmark thetrumpet.com. You can make it your homepage too, because there's a lot of information out there, and it's not very valuable. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. Thanks for joining us online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, you can do that at kpcgfm. And any emails you'd like to send those to comments@kpcg.fm. We'll be happy to take a look at those for you. We're looking at a book this week. Great again. It's a free book at thetrumpet.com. And if you've gotten it before, it does have an updated version, so you might want to get that. But if you haven't, certainly get this book. It's free. You can get it right now at thetrumpet.com. The Miracle of Technology, you can download it. You can read it right now, any which way you want to access it. Or the old-fashioned way, you can request it and have it sent to you, which is a nice booklet. So it's nice because you can take notes, you can highlight things, and I when I'm reading, especially if I'm reading for a longer period of time, I like to have a book or something in my hands.
And it does have substantial space in the margins for writing notes, and so it is almost made for taking notes.
And so this book, great again, obviously, it's not a takeoff on President Trump's slogan. He I don't know. Maybe they mutually happened, but it was talked about ahead of time. But is a really important book, and it talks about quite a few things going on in the U.S. that have impacted the country over the last few years, certainly. And talking about the fourth chapter today, the deadly deal with Cuba. This was big news a few years ago, and it's totally fallen out of the headlines today. You don't hear anything about it, but it's important, and we're going to cover some of the history of Cuba, of this deal with Cuba, and also take a look at who are the winners and the losers in this situation and why it matters in the first place. And so a few write-ups here, or a few comments from this book. It's written by Mr. Gerald Fleury, the editor-in-chief of thetrumpet.com, and says, in December of 2014, U.S. President Barack Obama surprised the world by announcing that America would restore diplomatic ties with Cuba after 53 years of hostility. The terms of the deal completely favored Cuba. Cuba did not have to abandon communism nor reform its dictatorial governance. The U.S. got nothing out of this deal. And this is such a strange deal to make because Cuba can't really, they have nothing to bring to the table. Not only do they have nothing to bring to the table, they didn't bring anything to the table. they didn't even pretend to embrace the U.S. You remember after that deal, President Obama went down there, and they treated him like a, you know, third-class citizen, or I don't know what how you'd express that, but they didn't treat him well. They didn't treat him like a president or a dignitary of a great country. I don't even think many people showed up at the airport.
All right.
It was terrible.
That's true, and there's not a whole lot of respect to be gained from defying the definition of a deal. A deal is where both sides exchange something because it should benefit both sides, theoretically. What Mr. Obama did was he gave a lot of things to Cuba and did not expect anything in return. And it wasn't just a matter of him being a good Samaritan or anything like that. He just felt like doing it, and he has some, well, really, if we're being blunt, he has some affinity for their belief system down there.
Yeah, it's funny because at that time, if you were to listen to the way the media was talking about Cuba, you would think, like, well, this is a secret paradise.
Yeah,
amazing down there. It's like they're stuck in the 50s because all the old cars.
And well, they
Adidas
always
tracksuits for some reason, but
that is it's funny to see national leaders walking around in those.
you're not very credible if you're wearing a sweatsuit as your work outfit. But but as this book points out, you know, why did this deal happen? Well, it was largely the handiwork of the Vatican. They were heavily involved. In early summer of 2014, the Pope appealed to both leaders by letter, urging them to exchange prisoners and improve relations. The Vatican later hosted a clandestine meeting between the two sides in Rome. However, it was actually Pope Francis's predecessor who put the plan into motion. In 2012, Pope Benedict XVI began pressuring the United States to normalize relations with Cuba, and Francis carried on Benedict's efforts. After months of working behind the scenes, the momentous deal was sealed. Its announcement really did surprise the world. So that was it happened there in 2014, but the deal was kind of ongoing for a while. They were working on it. They were being pressured by the Vatican to make this deal. And so you have to think, well, why? What would be the point of that? And we'll see that as we go through here. Just some quick history about Cuba. In 1492, Christopher Columbus claimed the islands, including Cuba, for Spain. At the time was a champion of Catholicism. Christopher Columbus is obviously not popular today in the U.S.
People are trying to tear down his statue. They think he's committed some sort of racist deed. I can't really figure out the logic of it.
It's bizarre, to say the least. But that's what he was doing in 1492. He was claiming Cuba for Spain. And then just 1 year later, Pope Alexander VI commanded Spain to conquer, colonize, and Catholicize the quote-unquote pagans of Cuba and the rest of the New World. So that's pretty blunt language. That's what they wanted to do. The three C's, conquer, colonize, and Catholicize. It's sketchy. And then in the early 1500s, Charles V gained power over the Netherlands, Spain, and Germany. In Rome in 1530, the Pope crowned him emperor, and he headed what's the Fourth Resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire, if you know much about that. So a lot of history there, but again, Cuba was really a part of that and part of that growth and expansion into the New World. And one of the reasons that they wanted to do that was because they had a lot of wealth they were bringing back from the New World, lots of gold, lots of things they were getting from places over in the West, and so they needed a port, and Cuba was that port for them. So back at that time, it was very essential to be used as a stopping point for all the wealth that they were transferring back into that Holy Roman Empire.
And that history is really helpful to look at because some people might look at Cuba today and they'd see a communist dictatorship. Supposedly, communism is irreligious. There's no religion at all. And yet they do seem to also have a Catholic influence there. That's because for hundreds of years now, they've been involved with the Holy Roman Empire or with whoever was in charge of Spain or something like that. And so Catholicism has had an influence on them as well.
Yeah, it's deeply entrenched in their roots, and that's a great point that you bring out, because modern Cuba is a communist nation, but it's only been communist for about 6 decades or so, which, you know, isn't that long, especially as you get older. But they have been a Catholic country for almost 500 years. So they have very, very deep roots there with that. And even today, the stats are that are in this book, between 60 and 65% of Cubans say they are Catholics. So they still have a very heavy influence there in that island. But, you know, you can think of Cuba as not being that big of a deal. It's a small little island, but it has great strategic value, not just back then when they were using it as this port, but it's very important today as well. One of the big reminders, the very recent reminder of why it is when 1962, when the U.S. discovered that the Soviet Union had missiles in Cuba, otherwise known as the Cuban Missile Crisis, I guess. And it's an aircraft carrier, and it's right off the shores of the U.S., not very far away at all. And so if listeners remember that, and even if you don't remember it personally, but you can go look at the history, we were on the brink of nuclear war because of Russia putting missiles there in Cuba.
That's something like 90 miles south of Florida. That's extremely close. It's so close that people trying to flee their miserable lives in Cuba have been able to build rickety sea craft and actually get to Florida on those things without sinking in a lot of cases. That just shows you how close the two countries are to each other. So when you have a nation that is as hostile as Cuba to the U.S., just 90 miles south, you have to be paying attention to them and who's influencing them and where the power is coming from, what type of projects they have going on, because they really at one time did hope to launch missiles into the U.S.
And there's no way that it would be so – they're so close that you couldn't react.
Yeah,
I mean, you can look at the maps and see some of the major U.S. cities on the East Coast. You couldn't react in time by the time you knew that something was happening. At least as far as I know, maybe they've got something that could take care of it, but it would be, you wouldn't have a lot of warning, to say the least. It's not a chance worth taking, but you bring out a really good point there that it is a strategic area, and if nations are there and influencing Cuba, or, you know, powers, entities of certain from certain places that are against the United States, then Cuba becomes a very serious issue for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so just reconciling with Cuba, and it's funny to say reconcile. The Obama administration didn't really there was no reconciliation. It was just saying, hey, you know, we're going to normalize relations. And Cuba's like, all right, great. And they just keep on doing what they're doing, including being influenced by very anti-U.S. Forces.
Well, like you said, they didn't treat our president well at all. He earned no respect from Cuba by doing what he did. In fact, he outraged a lot of people, Cuban dissidents, for example, who are being oppressed by the dictatorship, because he basically gave the dictatorship a means to live a more luxurious life while the people suffer. He opened up a lot of business avenues in Cuba that were not there before, and so now a lot of American travel is coming in there. Tourism is thriving down there, or at least it was while he made that deal, and a lot of business interests are taking place. That's actually hurting the people and only helping the dictatorship. So really, America gained nothing from it. The dictatorship gained a lot from it. The Cuban people didn't get anything from it at all, and in fact, they're probably worse off.
Yeah, and that's what happens. The top takes everything and nobody else gets it. Except they get a lot of misery. But there's other interesting history here with Cuba after the Cuban Missile Crisis there around 1962. Obviously, it was averted. The U.S. did see those missiles and was able to stop it in time. But we were close to full-on nuclear war at the time. But then shortly after that, something, of course, very historic happened, and that was in 1963. It was November the 22nd. President John F. Kennedy was assassinated. And that's been always a mysterious sort of thing, like exactly what happened there. There's been movies about it. There's been countless books about it. But there's been new information released about that as well. And this book, Great Again, talks about some of that and says Lee Harvey Oswald, a former U.S. Marine, defected to the Soviet Union in 1959. He returned to the U.S. in 1962. You can imagine what he was doing over there. 2 days after the president's assassination, he was murdered by a nightclub owner under dubious circumstances. I believe he was coming back through the airport, and the guy shot him, which was... I think you see the footage of it. It's always very strange because you think, how did that guy get in there with a gun? Like, how did he get that close to a, you know, Lee Harvey Oswald? I never understood that.
That is, it really does seem like a strange situation where maybe Lee Harvey Oswald was taking orders from the Soviet Union. Maybe it was a retaliation for what happened in Cuba, averting the Cuban Missile Crisis. But then they didn't, maybe people didn't want him around to say why he was doing what he did, and so they killed him.
Yeah, didn't want him to spill the beans, maybe. Who knows? Interesting, but there's a lot of interesting circumstances there. The Warren Commission, which investigated the slaying, concluded that Oswald acted alone. Nothing to see here. Move on, everyone. Most Americans still reject this explanation, and new evidence corroborates their suspicion. On September 16th, 2015, just a little while ago, the Washington Times reported 3 days after John F. Kennedy was shot and killed in Dallas, U.S. intelligence officials told President Lyndon B. Johnson that they had confirmed that assassin Lee Harvey Oswald had recently traveled to Mexico City to visit both the Cuban and Soviet embassies. That's how Cuba's in the mix again, according to a half-century-old briefing memo declassified on Wednesday. So the American president was murdered by a Marxist who was in contact with the Soviet Union and Cuba just days beforehand, and it took the government 52 years to declassify this relevant information, and still large sections of the document are blotted out. So that's pretty recent revelations that have come out there. There's a lot going on, and, you know, why did President Kennedy get killed? Was it revenge? Was it retaliation for the Cuba Missile Crisis? You know, those answers, I don't know, are... that they're out there factually right now, but it is certainly interesting to see how all of those events are very closely related in terms of time, and then if you look at the traveling of Lee Harvey Oswald.
One would at least think that those documents could have been released a little bit sooner than, 52 years after the fact. So even the fact that it took that long, maybe they were trying to wait until outrage over the assassination died down, and then it was so long afterward that we can't do much about it anymore.
Yeah, I wonder why they kept it quiet. I wonder if their thinking was, if we reveal this, we're going to have to go to war with Russia.
Yeah, probably. That's probably a good reason not to increase hostilities, because you don't want war with another nation that also has nuclear weapons and is very hostile to you.
Yeah, so really, those are really interesting times there. But again, it does have a lot to do with Cuba. So you have all this history of Cuba and what they've been involved in, what their regime's been involved in. And remember, the Castro regime's been around a long time, both of the brothers. And so this is their history, too. These are the people we're talking about today. Of course, Fidel Castro died a while back. I think Raul's still alive.
I think so, too.
Yeah, they're old. They survived a long time. And as Great again points out here, the Obama administration, though, opened the doors to diplomatic relations with Cuba. And now, if you want to make contact with communists, you can just go to Havana, 90 miles south of Florida. That's how close they are. That's the history of that regime. And yet, without them changing in any way, all of a sudden we say we just want to normalize relations.
And you did say that a Marxist killed our president. Well, it does seem like a lot of Marxist ideas are taking root in the radical left in this country, and maybe that's a reason why our president would get along so well with the Cuban leader. There are a lot of connections there that people should want to look at more closely. Why should we have any reason at all, unless we agree with what the dictatorship is doing, to give them any favors, to do them any favors when any chance they get, they're trying to wipe us off the map?
Yeah, and this brings all around to, I think, a pretty obvious question. Like, okay, well, who benefits from the Cuba deal? Like, why would we want to do this? Why would people be interested? Why would different powers be so interested in this deal happening? And luckily for us, it's pointed out here why. And Great again. And again, we're just touching on the highlights here and the high spots, so there's a lot more to get into with this book. It's at thetrumpet.com. And it says, anyone familiar with the Castro regime's track record knows that legitimizing and propping it up is not in the interest of the people of Cuba, as you mentioned earlier, Grant. The deal was based on hopes of some American leaders that the Cuban government would reform, but they required no concessions. When would that ever work? You know, I hope my kid does better, but I'm not going to in any way require him to change.
It's like giving a kid who fails every test candy after every test and saying, well, make sure you do better on the next one. I'm not going to take away the candy, but just make sure you do better on the next one.
Give it a better effort next time. Next time, try not to nuke us. And it is extremely rare, it says, for dictators to voluntarily loosen their grip on power. Yeah, I don't know. I can't think of any example of that happening.
Humans in general, if they get that much power, they never loosen it. Even in this government, you never see the American government substantially downsizing. No matter how small government the president might be, the government never downsizes. Whenever the government takes power, it keeps that power forever.
Yeah, it expands it. But so, you know, so if people are saying, well, look, the Cuban people are they're suffering. Yeah, they are, but they're still suffering. This isn't helping them out at all. There's been some really interesting write-ups at thetrumpet.com. I'm sure they're still up there about Cuba. And I remember a couple of Trumpet Hour programs where talk about some of the things that the Castro regime does to its own people. It's beyond barbaric. You know, people want to talk about, you know, Hitler and what he did, which was horrific. Well, there's a lot going on that's not that far from that. And certainly that's been happening to the Cuban people.
That's true. And people do try to justify President Obama's Cuba deal by saying the Cuban people are suffering and that somehow this deal is helping them. Well, if he really did have the aim of helping the Cuban people, why did he end the wet foot, dry foot policy? Why did he allow those fleeing from Cuba and setting foot on Floridian soil to actually be sent back? Why did he do that right before he left office?
Right. And by the way, the Cuban Americans that have come over, they hate this deal. Mm-hmm. They've hated it. So was this deal good for the U.S.? It says, under the Castro regime, Cuba has acted as one of the Western Hemisphere's major sponsors of terrorism and drug trafficking. Legitimizing it is a victory for those who want to see America fall. Giving in to that communist regime emboldens America's enemies. It's they haven't changed their ways. They're still involved in terrorism, drug trafficking. You know, you name it. And so this deal has not helped the United States at all. But this gets to the heart of what this deal is all about. It says there is a lot of anti-capitalist ideology in the world, and this ideology targets America primarily. The Cuba deals, they benefit all those powers that are against the United States of America, and there's quite a few of them out there. They're anti-capitalist. The United States is the chief capitalist nation. And so this deal is a direct attack on the capitalist United States. So you have to look at the people that are involved in the mix there and the deal, and that's really at the heart of why they wanted the U.S. to make this deal with Cuba, because it is going after the United States and undermining us in a lot of ways.
This chapter of Great Again does skillfully tie together all these connections, and you know, the Catholic Church did largely broker a thawing of relations between America and Cuba. If you read any of the documents put out by the church, it does seem like in some ways you could actually equate some of their beliefs to communism in terms of, you know, spreading the wealth around to everybody. It sounds nice and it sounds virtuous, but when you put it into practical terms and you actually try to make that happen in any nation, you get what they have in Cuba.
Well, any nation that says they want to spread the wealth around, what they mean by that is, I'm going to take all of your wealth. We'll keep like 90% of it for ourselves, and then the rest of you peasants can fight over the crumbs.
Right.
That's what happens.
It is really amazing how people continue to support these types of regimes when everyone who there are people fleeing. For one thing, if any amount of people are fleeing from a nation, that means that something is horribly wrong in that nation. You don't see people fleeing from America. It never happens because America is the greatest nation in the world. People are fleeing from Cuba because they're being oppressed, because the communist system doesn't work. There are still academics who say that the healthcare system and the educational system in Cuba are amazing. Well, then why are you not down there working? Oh, maybe because you'd make cents on the dollar compared to what you make now.
Yeah, there's ask the people that have lived there. It's not what they're trying to make it out to be. But this is all leading to something really important, and it's talked about in this book. It says, the Bible prophesies of a deadly economic siege that is going to strike America. It will cause one-third of the terrifying damage that will be suffered in the Great Tribulation, if you're familiar with some of those prophecies. That siege is about somebody controlling trade routes, so it is not difficult to see how Cuba could play a strategic role in that. And so when you look at this Cuba deal, you have to start thinking about economy. You have to start thinking about trade routes. You have to start thinking about an economic siege. The different powers that are anti-capitalist, anti-U.S., and the U.S. getting squeezed out of some of those trade markets. And right now, I think most people think, well, we're the biggest nation in the world, most powerful. No one can do that to us. Well, some people have some designs on it, and the Bible talks about that happening.
There is a certain amount of naivety in America where we think that all nations just want to get along. Human nature is virtually good, and we're all trying to just coexist peacefully on the planet, when most nations actually want to be the chief nation in the world. They want to dominate, and we're seeing that. If America is in the top spot right now and other nations want to dominate, that automatically means those nations want America to fall. We have to acknowledge that, and we have to face that hard reality.
Yeah, this is a really fascinating chapter, and just because you haven't heard about Cuba in the news a lot probably lately, don't forget about it. It's a really dangerous deal that occurred. It's great again. It's a free book at thetrumpet.com. This is the fourth chapter, The Deadly Deal with Cuba. And again, we just touched on some of the high spots. You have to get in there and really read it and think about it. And it's really shocking to see what is happening and where some of these things are leading. And so that's one of the, I think, one of the dangers of the 24-hour news cycle is that the really important stuff, even if it gets touched on, it kind of gets shoved to the back and there's some new event to talk about. Sometimes important, sometimes not, but who's talking about the Cuba deal?
Well, possibly a way to relate that Cuba deal to some things that Americans might think is more interesting. What about the last election? If President Obama, right before he left office, alienated so many Cuban Americans, did he possibly swing the state of Florida for President Trump? Is it possible that in a way that kind of a deal alienated so many people in America that his preferred candidate, Hillary Clinton, lost the election?
Yeah, it's a good point. There's always pushback on those different elections. So sometimes they can end up kind of sabotaging their own selves, I guess. Make sure you get that book. Great again. It's at thetrumpet.com. Really important, really interesting read as well. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. For myself, Dwight Falk, and Grant Turgeon, have a great rest of your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.